We're actually reading two sections this morning, or this evening rather, the first 11 verses of chapter 33, and then the last verses of chapter 34, 29 to 35. We're taking the beginning and the end of what remains of the historical narrative in the book of Exodus. You'll see as we read them that they belong together. In fact, they form an inclusio surrounding the revelation of Yahweh's glory to Moses that we will read next time. We've said on a number of occasions that Exodus is the story of the Lord's presence with his people. It's concerned with the matter, the reality of that presence. And that is the theme again in our texts this evening, but in a melancholy way. We're face to face with God's presence, but also with the fact that it has been removed from his people because of their sins of unbelief and disobedience. So, Exodus 33, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go up to the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'I will give it to your descendants.' I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way." The emphatic point of this narrative is that a substitution is taking place. An angel will have the task of leading Israel through the wilderness to the promised land. Yahweh himself is putting distance between himself and his people. We tend to think that Israel's rebellion at Kadesh Barnea, when they followed the advice of the 10 faithless spies, was the reason that this generation was consigned to perish in the wilderness and never to see the promised land. Perhaps so. But a separation between Yahweh and this generation of Israel has already occurred. What we have here is a virtual refusal on the Lord's part to be too closely allied with his people. Moses will appeal this refusal in verses 15 and following, and the Lord will relent to a degree. But as we will see, Israel will not know the presence of the Lord as she has heretofore. This, along with the promise of punishment, which we read last time in 32-34, is the first hint of the things that are to come. The problem is that the Lord's patience with Israel has been exhausted. When the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments. This gesture was a reaction to the news of the moment, an act of mourning. But it was to become a custom in Israel not to wear gold jewelry, a custom that will be reflected in the narrative of the book of Judges and the story of Gideon, if you remember. Not only had this sort of jewelry been used to make the golden bull, but the Lord would have need of it for the making of the vessels to be manufactured for use in the sanctuary. You'll read about that in 35:22. Israel, even though often and sometimes largely an unbelieving community, would have seemed to the peoples of her world a puritanical people in worship, in morals, in dress. That is to be regularly the case. And Christian people should learn to wear this reproach of the world as a crown. Now, Moses used to make a tent. I'm sorry, I didn't read the whole. For the Lord had said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites, you are a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you, even for a moment, I might destroy you. Now take off your ornaments, and I will decide what to do with you." So the Israelites stripped off their ornaments at Mount Horeb. Now, Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it the Tent of Meeting. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the Tent of Meeting outside the camp. Now, the Tent of Meeting will be the name that will eventually be given to the tabernacle, as you'll read in chapter 39, verse 22, or 32. But the tabernacle itself had not yet been built. This tent is a temporary and preliminary structure. But what is clear, once again, is that the location of the tent outside the camp represents another separation between the Lord and his people. Remember, the plan that the Lord had, that Moses had received from the Lord, required the tabernacle to be in the middle of the camp with the 12 tribes surrounding it in a square. Yahweh is not removing his presence altogether, but he will not dwell in the midst of the camp. The camp had been defiled by the golden bull and its worship. The holy God would not now make his dwelling in the midst of such people. Moses, as we will learn, would go out to the tent and return from it, and the people would prostrate themselves at a distance when the presence of God descended on the tent, but they did not go near except as individuals. And the individual who went to the meeting to seek guidance, to pray, to worship, had to speak, as it were, to the Lord, away from the rest of the people, outside, separated from the rest of the nation. But once there, outside the camp, language that the author of Hebrews will employ in 13:13, willing to make that separation between himself and the people, communion with the Lord was still possible. The people, in any case, are represented here as being chastened, and once again, dutiful servants of the Lord, doleful over the threat of the Lord's separation from them on account of their sin, but time will prove the repentance shallow and short-lived. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp, and whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrance to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. As Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they all stood and worshipped, each at the entrance to his tent. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. In Numbers chapter 12, verse 8, the phrase is mouth to mouth rather than face to face. The point is not that Moses literally saw God, something the Bible elsewhere teaches us that no one ever has or can, but that Yahweh spoke to Moses directly and not in dreams and visions. It was the greatest role that Moses was to play in Israel, that what he heard from God, he then repeated to God's people. He stands first in a long line of men who would be the instruments of the Lord's revelation. Now across the page to chapter 34 and verse 29. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. As you may remember, the Vulgate, the Latin Bible that was the Bible of Christendom for more than 1,000 years. The Vulgate mistranslated the verb and rendered it as having horns instead of radiant, having horns. And that's why Moses appears with horns in some medieval works of art. This is Moses' second descent from the summit of Mount Sinai. He has a second copy now of the two tablets, replacing those that he had destroyed before the golden calf. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, so Aaron and all the leaders of the community came back to him, and he spoke to them. Afterward, all the Israelites came near him, and he gave them all the commands the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking to them, he put a veil over his face. But whenever he entered the Lord's presence to speak with him, he removed the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, they saw that his face was radiant. Then Moses would put the veil back over his face until he went in to speak with the Lord. It's very important for the point we're going to make that while they were initially afraid, they got used to this and they understood how it worked. And they would come and listen to Moses as he delivered the revelation from God before Moses put the veil back over his face. Now, I want you to put your finger in Paul's second epistle to the Corinthians, chapter 3. We'll get there in just a moment. What is very important to understand and what is not usually understood is that this last paragraph, 34, 29 to 35, makes the same point as did the first two paragraphs we read from the beginning of chapter 33. It's describing nothing less than the distance, the remove at which Israel now lives from Yahweh on account of her unbelief and her disobedience. The Lord, in answer to Moses' intercession, did not remove his presence from his people entirely, but his presence could no longer be enjoyed by them as once it had been. In other words, Moses' veiling his radiant face has the same meaning as does the Lord sending an angel before Israel instead of going himself, has the same meaning as Moses pitching the tent of meeting, not in the center of the encampment, but outside of it. It's true that Moses' intercession, of which we read in 33, 15 to 17, results in some relaxation of the Lord's separation of himself from Israel, but only some. The tent remains outside the camp. Moses continues to veil his face. But what precisely does that action symbolize or signify? Is it really an act of judgment that we see there? Here we read only the bare bones of the story. Moses came down from Mount Sinai with a radiant face, reflecting the glory of the Lord in whose presence he had just been. Afterward, this happened repeatedly. Whenever he entered the tent of meeting to speak with the Lord, he would come away with a face that was glowing with the reflected glory of God. And then he would deliver to the people of Israel whatever communication he had received from the Lord, and then he would veil or cover his face. It is, however, a commonplace of Old Testament revelation that access to the glory of God, the sight of God's glory, is a powerful symbol of acceptance with God and the immense privilege it is to be granted that acceptance as an unworthy sinner. When Paul will later say, so famously in Romans 3:23, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, or as the New English Bible even better has it, all have sinned and have been deprived of God's glory, he's using the same idea to make his point about salvation and the unworthiness and need of sinful human beings. Sin deprives us of God's glory, of the privilege of seeing it and of living our lives in the presence of it. And that's what happened here. Israel was deprived of God's glory. She would see it when Moses was delivering God's word, but after that it was covered so that she could not see it. She could not enjoy staring at it. This was an act of judgment on Moses' part, on God's part, against Israel. Now, this has not been widely understood, in large part because of a serious misunderstanding of Paul's use of this history in 2 Corinthians 3. I invite your attention to that text because the interpretation of our text is given in that text, if only it is properly translated and properly understood. The story of the interpretation of 2 Corinthians 3 is too long and too complicated to tell in any detail, but I want to make just a few points necessary, essential to the understanding of Exodus 34, 29 and following. First, the NIV's translation of 2 Corinthians 3, 7, 11 and 13 is a serious and consequential mistake. It became common in the middle of the 20th century to render Paul's verb katagero in the passive or the middle fading. And in a number of modern translations, you have fading. The glory on Moses' face was fading. And this is regarded as of some significance to what Paul means to tell you about this history from Exodus 34. The glory that Moses was covering with the veil that was reflected on his face was a fading glory. The case for that translation is very weak and that translation is being abandoned as we speak. Those of you who have brought the English Standard Version to church this evening will see that they did not translate the verb as fading, but as brought to an end. The translators of the ESV would not commit a blunder such as fading in this translation. The verb is an important verb for Paul. It occurs 14 times in his letters and almost always in very significant theological contexts. It never means fading. It always means to nullify, to cancel, to do away with. And the question then becomes, how was the glory canceled or nullified or done away with? And the obvious answer is, if you're reading the history that Paul is referring us to, it was canceled, it was nullified, it was done away with by the veil that Moses put upon his face to hide that glory from Israel, to keep her from being able to have access to it. This, in fact, is precisely what Paul himself goes on to say in verse 13 and explains the reason as being Israel's hardness of heart, her unbelief, a condition, he says in verses 14 and 15, still afflicts Israel in his day, as it did the centuries before in Moses' day. It's worth pointing out that Exodus 34 says nothing at all about the glory fading on Moses' face. It's also worth pointing out that the argument of Paul in 2 Corinthians 3 doesn't have anything to do with the difference in the glory between Moses' time and Paul's time, as is very widely said or thought. Paul's talking about two different responses to the gospel. He admits, as he begins this section at the end of chapter 2, that as a preacher of the gospel, sometimes he is an aroma of life and sometimes he is an aroma of death. Sometimes he rings the bell, the good news of salvation, and sometimes he rings the funeral bell of eternal loss. The difference isn't in the message. It isn't in the gospel. It lies instead in the response that men make to that message. Some with faith, some with unbelief. And as so often elsewhere in the New Testament, Israel is brought in as an example of people who hear the gospel, but who do not believe it. In fact, she is the Bible's great example of the consequences of unbelief. Israel in the wilderness. At the end of this section, Paul makes the same point. In 2 Corinthians 4, 1 through 6, remember the chapter divisions are not Paul's, he admits again that he too gets both responses. He speaks of his gospel being veiled to those who are perishing. And the result, once again back to the example of Exodus 34, is that they cannot see the light of the gospel in the glory of Christ. In summary, Paul is talking about a gospel ministry and the two different results it produces, depending upon whether people believe or do not believe. He contrasts Moses' ministry to an unbelieving people with his own ministry to the Corinthians who believed in large numbers. Moses had to veil his face as a sign of God's judgment. Paul did not. At least, he didn't in Corinth. There were places where he had to shake the dust of his feet off against a city, but not in Corinth. Second, Paul's use of the concept of boldness in his argument demonstrates that Paul at least thought that Moses' veiling of his face was a sign of shame and mourning and judgment. I'll simplify the argument, but it is a key point in Paul's argument here that no matter how strained his relationship had become with the Corinthian Christians, he can deal with them in freedom and boldness. He contrasts in chapter 3, verse 12, his behavior with Moses's in this regard. He says, "We are very bold, not like Moses." The word translated bold is a word that was taken over from Greek into Aramaic, and in Aramaic, it is often found used synonymously with a proverbial expression that means to uncover the face. In Aramaic, to cover the face is a sign of shame and mourning, while to uncover the face is a sign of confidence and freedom. There are many arguments that can be raised in support of this conclusion, and it's not widely denied in the literature. I won't bore you with those, but the conclusion is important. Once again, Paul is contrasting his ministry with that of Moses. Moses had to cover his face, a sign of mourning and shame because of Israel's unbelief. That, by the way, is the conclusion we would come to simply reading Exodus 34 in its historical context. Israel had betrayed the Lord. She didn't deserve to bask in the reflected glory of God. Paul did not have to employ such a device because the Corinthians had responded to Paul's gospel preaching with faith. Paul's ministry was different from Moses's because the Corinthians' response to it was different than Israel's response had been to Moses's ministry. That's the difference. Both in Exodus 33 and 34 and in 2 Corinthians 3, the subject is the vast difference that faith makes, or the absence of faith makes. I won't go any further into 2 Corinthians 2 through 4, or Paul's argument there, but I want to help you see the significance of understanding Exodus 34, as well as 2 Corinthians 3, in these terms. The typical evangelical, even the typical Reformed commentator on Exodus 34, 29 to 35, and 2 Corinthians 3, finds here, almost as it were, by inevitable accident, a contrast between the two epochs, and a demonstration of the inferiority of the Old Testament in comparison with the New Testament. Believe me, I spent a year of my life working on 2 Corinthians 3, and that is the view very widely taken in the literature. The idea of fading glory fits neatly into that understanding of the passage. The fact that the glory was fading is supposed to indicate that the religion of Moses was impermanent, defective, needed to be replaced by something better, permanent, lasting. With respect to Exodus 34, then, the idea, and this is everywhere taught, the idea is that Israel did not have full access to the presence of God because of the defective arrangements of the covenant in those days, a fact indicated by Moses' veil and the fading glory. But now, in the Christian era, we have full access to the presence of God. But that's not what either text says. It's very plainly not what either text says. The problem for Israel was not that she could not enjoy the presence of God. She could. She had enjoyed that presence. The problem is that she has now lost that presence on account of her sin. Moses hadn't lost it. Joshua hadn't lost it. But the rest of Israel, by and large, had. But what is more, we can lose it too. There's nothing that happens in Exodus 32 through 34 that doesn't happen again in the New Testament era. Paul makes a point on several occasions of warning his readers that God's rejection of Israel in the wilderness is an example of what could happen to them if they do not live before the Lord in faithfulness. Hebrews is one long argument that what happened to Israel, who heard the gospel but did not combine it with faith, as he says in chapter 4, and for that reason was excluded from the rest of God. That will happen to anyone nowadays who does the same thing. To a Christian congregation, he writes, if we deliberately keep on sinning after we have received the knowledge of the truth, this is what Israel did. No sacrifice for sins is left, but only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. The Lord will judge His people. It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And among the last words spoken by the incarnate Christ to His church are those to the church in Laodicea in Revelation 3:14 to 22. I know your deeds, that you are neither hot nor cold. I wish you were either one or the other. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. The effect of those interpretations of texts like these that purport to find here evidence of the inferiority of the Old Testament revelation and its covenantal arrangements, and the superiority in contrast of the New Testament arrangements, is to suggest that now in the new epoch, we have what Israel did not. They had limited access to God. We have full access to God. Their religious provision could take them only partway to God, but ours take us all the way. I've heard such interpretations all my life, and you have too. But they aren't true. They aren't true by the express, the repeated, and the emphatic witness of the Bible itself. We are, as the New Testament is always reminding us, in the same spiritual situation Israel was in. We live in the same spiritual world. We have the same alternatives set before us. Faith in salvation on the one hand, unbelief in God's judgment on the other. The problem with Israel and the reason for Moses' veil had nothing to do with any defects in the covenant that God had made with her. It had only to do with her lack of faith and her disobedience. And church people in the new era can be just as guilty of that want of faith and that disobedience as ever Israel was. In fact, she has been on a far grander scale than anything Israel knew. We're warned of this over and over again in the New Testament. If there is some putative difference between the salvation and the presence of God that could be experienced by believers in the Old Testament in comparison with what can be experienced by believers in the new epoch, we are never told what it is. And Israel in the wilderness is never used as an example of what was true for believers in the ancient epoch. She is always an example of what happens when the gospel is not combined with faith. The problem with interpretations of Exodus 34, 29 to 35 that take the symbolism of Moses' veil as having to do with some defect in the covenant that God made with his people in that ancient era, the problem is that we then miss the powerful warning of this text. We assume that it's not addressed to us because our situation isn't like theirs. But Israel at Sinai is a people about to be finally rejected by the Lord, and that because of her unbelief and her disobedience. That's the warning the New Testament writers invariably take from this history. 1 Corinthians 10. Let the man who thinks he is standing take heed lest he fall. Hebrews and elsewhere. The New Testament writers press this history home, and we're to press it home to our own hearts. We must not be like Israel at Mount Sinai. And if we are, the same thing is going to happen to us that happened to them. They will lose the presence of God. We will lose it as well. That's how impossibly serious and stern the Bible is in applying this history in the New Testament to our consciences. Are we at all like they? There at the foot of Mount Sinai. Are we sure we are not like they? But there's something else to say in conclusion. To many Christians, by that I mean to many people in the church today, Israel's situation as described in Exodus 33 and 34 is in fact ideal. They don't want to have God too close. Surely not at their office, perhaps least of all at their home. Yet they don't want to lose touch with God altogether either. They would not have even unbelieving Israel's good sense to mourn and wail the partial withdrawal of the Lord's presence. Actually, they prefer it that way. They want the tent of meeting a few miles from home. They can go there and come back of a Sunday morning and go on with life without much more thought about it. But Moses knew better. If God did not go with Israel, they might just as well be a pagan nation. What difference was there then between them and the nations anymore? But Christianity, true Christianity, subjective redemption, absolutely offers the privilege of the presence of the living God with his people and absolutely requires it. Here is the great difference between the Muslim and the Christian understanding of God, of the knowledge of God, of salvation. Islam's God is God at a distance. the God who is far from us and cannot be known. Christianity's God is the God who is drawn near, the living God who makes himself known to individuals. In 1 John, we read of the Lord making his tabernacle among us. And in 2 Corinthians 3, with unveiled faces, we behold the glory of God. But if that beholding the glory of God is in fact a reality that can be known and experienced by human beings, if it is really possible to know the presence of God personally, then it becomes hugely important that we live in that presence in faithfulness. We must keep the covenant God has made with us, and that we live in faith and in obedience, in recognition of the impossibly great favor the Lord has bestowed upon his people, that we should be known as his children. If we do not, we are offending against the very presence of God. And if we prove ourselves a stiff-necked people, as he warns us in 33:5, he might destroy us. To behold the glory of God is a privilege, but a privilege that comes with a warning. Don't make light of this privilege. Don't live disobediently and faithlessly before it, or God will hold you to account. That is the first lesson of these texts from Exodus 33 and 34. Amen. As we come to the table of the Lord Jesus Christ, we're going to